Chapter 17. The baby woke him at 3:45 in the morning, and a bottle didn't comfort him. When the crying continued, Blaze began to be a little scared. He put a hand on Joe's forehead. The skin felt cool, but the screams he was producing were frightening in their intensity. Blaze was afraid he'd bust a blood vessel or something. He put Joe on the changing table. He took off his diapers and didn't see how they could be the problem either. They were dewy but not pooey. Blaze powdered the kid's bottom and put on fresh dighties. The screams continued. Blaze began to feel desperate as well as frightened. Blaze hoisted the shrieking infant onto his shoulder. He began to walk him in large circles around the kitchen. "Hush-a-bye," he said. "You're all right. You're okay. You're rockin'. Go to sleep. Hush-a-bye. Hush-a-boo. Zippity-doo. Shh, baby, shh. You wake up a bear sleepin' in the snow and it wanna eat us. Shh." Maybe it was the walking. Maybe it was the sound of Blaze's voice. In any case, Joe's scream shortened, then stopped. A few more turns around the shack's kitchen, and the baby's head fell against the side of Blaze's neck. His breathing lengthened into the long, slow strokes of sleep. Blaze put him carefully down in the cradle and began to rock it. Joe stirred, but did not wake. One small hand found its way into his mouth, and he began to chew furiously. Blaze started feeling better. Maybe there was nothing wrong after all. The book said they chewed their hands that way when they were teething or hungry, and he was pretty sure Joe wasn't hungry. He looked down at the baby and thought, more consciously this time, that Joe was sort of nice. Cute, too. Anybody could see that. It would be interesting to see him grow through all the stages the doctor talked about in child and baby care. Joe was about ready to start crawling right now. Several times since Blaze had brought him to the shack, the little fucker had been right up on his hands and knees. Then he'd walk, and words would start coming out of all that babble, and then he'd have somebody. The thought was unsettling. Blaze couldn't sleep anymore. He got up and turned on the radio, keeping the volume low. He searched through the before-sunrise chatter of 1,000 competing stations until he found the strong signal of WLOB. The 4 a.m. news had nothing fresh about the kidnapping. That seemed all right. The Gerards wouldn't be getting his letter until later today, maybe not even until tomorrow, depending on when the mail got picked up from the mall. Besides, he couldn't see why they should have any leads. He'd been careful, and except for that guy at Oakwood, Blaze had already forgotten his name, he thought this was what George would have called a real clean gag. Sometimes after they pulled a good con, he and George would buy a bottle of Four Roses. Then they would go to a movie and chase the roses with Coke they bought from the theater's refreshment stand. If the movie was a long one, George would sometimes be almost too drunk to walk by the time the final credits rolled. He was smaller, and the booze got to him quicker. They had been good times. They made Blaze think about the times when him and old Johnny Chelsman had palled around, snickering at those old movies the Nordica showed. Music came back on the radio. Joe was sleeping easily. Blaze thought he should go back to bed himself. There was a lot to do tomorrow. Or maybe even today. He wanted to send the Gerards another ransom note. He'd had a good idea for collecting the swag. It had come to him in a dream, a crazy one, he'd had the night before. He hadn't been able to make head or tail of it then. But the sweet, heavy, dreamless sleep from which the baby's crying had just roused him seemed to have clarified it. He'd tell them to drop the ransom from a plane, a small one that didn't fly very high. In the letter, he would say that the plane should fly south along Route 1 from Portland to the Massachusetts border, looking for a red signal light. Blaze knew just how to do it. Road flares. He would buy half a dozen from the hardware store in town and set them out in a little bunch at the place he picked. They would make a good hard light. He knew just the place, too. A logging road south of Ogunquit. There was a clearing on that road where the truckers sometimes pulled over to eat their lunches or catch a snooze in the sleepers they had behind their cabs. The clearing was close to Route 1, and a pilot flying down the highway couldn't miss road flares there, bunched close and shooting up like a big red flashlight. Blaze knew he still wouldn't have much time, but he thought he'd have enough. That first logging road led to a network of unmarked rambles with names like Boggy Stream Road and Bump Nose Road. Blaze knew them all. One of them led to Route 41, and from there he could turn back north, find a place to hide out until the heat cooled down. He had even considered Hedden House. It was empty and boarded up now, with a for sale sign in front of it. Blaze had been by there several times in the last few years, drawn back like a little kid who's had a scare in the neighborhood's supposedly haunted house. Only for him, H.H. really was haunted. He should know. He was one of the ghosts. Anyway, it was going to be all right. That was the main thing. It had been scary for a while, and he was sorry about the old lady, whose first name he had also forgotten. But now, it was turned into a real clean Blaze. He glanced toward the bathroom. It was George, all right. The bathroom door was ajar, the way George always left it when he wanted to talk while he took a dump. "Crap coming out at both ends," he'd said once when he was doing that, and both of them laughed. He could be funny when he wanted to, but he didn't sound like he was in a funny mood this morning. Also, Blaze thought he had closed that door when he came out of the bathroom himself the last time. He supposed a draft could have blown it open again, but he didn't feel any draft.
"They've almost got you, Blaze," George said.
Then in a kind of despairing growl,
"Dumb shit."
"Who does?" Blaze asked.
"The cops. Who do you think I meant? The Republican National Committee? The FBI, the state police, even the local humps in blue."
"No, they ain't. I've been doing real good, George. Honest. It's a clean gag. I'll tell you what I did. How careful I was."
"If you don't blow this shack, they'll have you by noon tomorrow."
"How? What?
You're so stupid, you can't even get out of your own way. I don't even know why I bother. You've made a dozen mistakes. If you're lucky, the cops have only found 6 or 8 so far."
Blaze hung his head. He could feel his face heating up.
"What should I do?"
"Roll out of this pop stand, right now."
"Where?"
"And get rid of the kid," George said, almost as an afterthought.
"What?
Did I stutter? Get rid of him. He's dead fucking weight. You can collect the ransom without him."
"But if I take him back, how will I—"
"I'm not talking about taking him back," George stormed. "What do you think he is, a fucking returnable bottle? I'm talking about killing him. Do it now."
Blaze shifted his feet. His heart was beating fast, and he hoped George would get out of the bathroom soon because he had to pee and he couldn't pee around no fucking ghost.
"Wait, I gotta think. Maybe, George, if you went for a little walk, when you came back, we could work this out."
"You can't think."
George's voice rose until it was almost a howl. It was as if he were in pain.
"Do the cops have to come and put a bullet in that stone you carry around on top of your neck before you realize that? You can't think, Blaze, but I can."
His voice dropped, became reasonable, almost silky.
"He's asleep now, so he'll never feel a thing. Get your pillow. It even smells like you. He'll like that. And put it over his face. Hold it down real tight. I bet the parents are sure it's happened already. They probably got to work making a little replacement Republican the next fucking night. Then you can take your shot at collecting the swag and go someplace warm. We always wanted that, right? Right?"
It was right. Someplace like Acapulco or the Bahamas.
"What do you say, Blazeroonie? Am I right or am I right with Evershop?"
"You're right, George, I guess."
"You know I am. It's how we roll."
Suddenly, nothing was simple anymore.
If George said the police were close and getting closer, on that he was probably right. George had always had a sharp nose for Blue, and the kid would slow him down if he left here in a hurry. George was right about that, too. His job now was to collect that fucking ransom and then hide out someplace. But killing the kid? Killing Joe? It suddenly occurred to Blaze that if he did kill him, and very, very gently, Joe would go right to heaven and be a baby angel there. So maybe George was right about that, too. Blaze himself was pretty sure he himself was going to hell, as were most other people. It was a dirty world, and the longer you lived, the dirtier you got. He grabbed his pillow and carried it back to the main room where Joe slept by the stove. His hand had fallen out of his mouth, but the fingers still bore the marks of his frantic chewing. It was a painful world, too, not just dirty, but painful. Teething was only the first and least of it. Blaze stood over the cradle holding the pillow, its case still dark with layers of hair tonic he'd left on it, back when he still had hair to put it on. George was always right, except when he wasn't. To Blaze, this still felt wrong. "Jeez," he said, and the word had a watery sound.
"Do it quick," George said from the bathroom. "Don't make him suffer."
Blaze knelt down and put the pillow over the baby's face. His elbows were in the cradle, placed on either side of that small rib cage, and he could feel Joe's breath pull in twice, stop, pull in once more, stop again. Joe stirred and arched his back. He twisted his head at the same time and began to breathe again. Blaze pressed the pillow tighter. He didn't cry. Blaze thought it might be better if the kid would cry. For the baby to die silently like an insect seemed worse than pitiful. It was horrible. Blaze took the pillow away. Joe turned his head, opened his eyes, closed them, smiled, and put his thumb in his mouth. Then he was just sleeping again. Blaze was breathing in ragged gasps. Sweat stood out in beads on his dented forehead. He looked at the pillow, still in his fisted hands, and dropped it as if it were hot. He began to tremble, and he grasped his belly to stop it. It wouldn't stop. Soon he was shaking all over. His muscles hummed like telegraph wires.
"Finish it, Blaze."
"No."
"If you don't, I'm in the breeze."
"Go then."
"You think you're gonna keep him, don't you?"
In the bathroom, George laughed. It sounded like a chuckling drainpipe.
"You poor sap. You let him live and he'll grow up hating your guts. They'll see to it, those good people. Those good, rich, asshole Republican millionaires. Didn't I never teach you nothing, Blaze? Let me say it in words even a sap can understand. If you were on fire, they wouldn't piss on you to put you out."
Blaze looked down at the floor where the terrible pillow lay. He was still shaking, but now his face was burning, too. He knew George was right. Still, he said, "I don't plan to catch on fire, George."
"You don't plan nothing. Blazer, when that happy little goo-goo doll of yours grows up to be a man, he'll go 10 miles out of his way just to spit on your fucking grave. Now, for the last time, kill that kid."
"No." Suddenly, George was gone. And maybe he really had been there all along. Because Blaze was sure he felt something, some presence, leave the shack. No windows opened and no doors slammed. But yes, the shack was emptier than it had been. Blaze walked over to the bathroom door and booted it open. Nothing there but the sink, a rusty shower, and the crapper. He tried to go back to sleep and couldn't. What he'd almost done hung inside his head like a curtain. And what George had said,
"They've almost got you.
And
if you don't blow this shack, they'll have you by noon tomorrow.
And worst of all,
when he grows up to be a man, he'll go 10 miles out of his way just to spit on your fucking grave."
For the first time, Blaze felt really hunted. In a way, he felt already caught, like a bug struggling in a web from which there is no escape. Lines from old movies started occurring to him. Take 'em dead or alive. If you don't come out now, we're coming in. And we're coming in shooting. Put up your hands, scumbucket. It's all over. He sat up sweating. It was going on 5, about an hour since the baby's cries had awakened him. Dawn was on the way, but so far it was just a faint orange line on the horizon. Overhead, the stars turned on their old axle, indifferent to it all.
If you don't blow this shack, they'll have you by noon.
But where would he go? He actually knew the answer to that question, had known for days. He got up and dressed in rapid, jerky gestures. Thermal underwear, woolen shirt, 2 pairs of socks, Levi's, boots. The baby was still sleeping, and Blaze had time only to spare him a glance. He got paper bags from under the sink and began filling them with diapers, Playtex nurser bottles, cans of milk. When the bags were full, he carried them out to the Mustang, which was parked beside the stolen Ford. At least he had a key for the Mustang's trunk, and he put the bags in there. He ran both ways. Now that he had decided to go, panic nipped his heels. He got another bag and filled it with Joe's clothes. He collapsed the changing table and took that, too, thinking incoherently that Joe would like it in a new place because he was used to it. The Mustang's trunk was small, but by transferring some of the bags to the back seat, he managed to cram the changing table in. The cradle could also go in the back seat, he reckoned. The baby dinners could go in the passenger seat footwell, with some baby blankets on top of them. Joe was really getting into the baby dinners, chowing down big time. He made one more trip, then started the Mustang and turned on the heater to make the car nice and toasty warm. It was 5:30. Daylight was advancing. The stars had paled. Now only Venus glowed brightly. Back in the house, Blaze lifted Joe out of his cradle and put him on his bed. The baby muttered but didn't wake. Blaze took the cradle out to the car. He went back in and looked around rather wildly. He took the radio from its place on the windowsill, unplugged it, wrapped the cord around it, and set it on the table. In the bedroom, he hauled his old brown suitcase, battered and scuffed white at the corners, from under the bed. He piled the remainder of his clothes in, helter-skelter. On top of these, he put a couple of girly magazines and a few comic books. He took the suitcase and his radio out to the car, which was starting to get full. Then he went back to the house for the last time. He spread a blanket, put Joe on it, wrapped him up, and put the entire bundle inside his jacket. Then he zipped the jacket up. Joe was awake now. He peered out of his cocoon like a gerbil. Blaze carried him out to the car, got in behind the wheel, and put Joe down on the passenger seat. "Now don't go rolling around there, Skinner," he said. Joe smiled and promptly pulled the blanket over his head. Blaze snorted a little chuckle, and in the same instant he saw himself putting the pillow over Joe's face. He shuddered. He backed out of the shed, turned the car around, and trundled down the driveway. And although he didn't know it, he was beating an area-wide necklace of roadblocks by less than 2 hours. He used back roads and secondary roads to skirt Portland and its suburbs. The steady sound of the motor and the heater's output sent Joe back to dreamland almost immediately. Blaze turned to his favorite country music station, which came on at sunrise. He heard the morning scripture reading, then a farm report, then a right-wing editorial from Freedom Line in Houston that would have sent George into paroxysms of profanity. Finally came the news.
"The search for the kidnappers of Joseph Girard IV continues," the announcer said gravely. "And there may be at least one new development."
Blaze pricked up his ears.
"A source close to the investigation claims that the Portland Postal Authority received a possible ransom demand in the mail last night and sent the letter by car directly to the Girard home. Neither local authorities nor Federal Bureau of Investigation lead agent Albert Sterling would offer any comment."
Blaze paid no attention to that part. The Girards had gotten his letter, and that was good. Next time he would have to call them. He hadn't remembered to bring any newspapers or envelopes or anything to make paste with anyway. And calling was always better. It was quicker.
And now the weather. Low pressure centered over upper New York State is expected to sweep east and hit New Englanders with the biggest snowstorm of the season. The National Weather Service has posted blizzard warnings, and snow may begin as early as noon today.
Blaze turned onto Route 136, then turned off it 2 miles up and onto the Stink Pine Road. When he passed the pond, now frozen, where he and Johnny had once watched beavers building their dam, he felt a dreamy and powerful sense of déjà vu. There was the abandoned farmhouse, where Blaze and Johnny and an Italian-looking kid had once broken in. They had found a stack of shoeboxes in one closet. There had been dirty pictures in one of them, men and women doing everything, women and women, even one of a woman and a horse or donkey, and they had looked all afternoon, their emotions drifting from amazement to lust to disgust. Blaze couldn't remember the Italian-looking kid's real name, only that everyone had called him Toe Jam. Blaze turned right at the fork a mile up and onto a pitted tertiary road that had been carelessly and narrowly plowed, then allowed to drift back in. A quarter of a mile up, beyond a curve the boys had called Sweet Baby Turn, Blaze had known why in the long ago, but it escaped him now. He came to a chain hung across the road. Blaze got out, went over to it, and pulled the rusted padlock free of its hasp with one gentle tug. He had been here before, and then half a dozen hard yanks had been needed to break the lock's old mechanism. Now he laid the chain down and surveyed the road beyond it. It hadn't been plowed since the last storm, but he thought the Mustang would roll okay if he backed up first and got some speed. He'd come back later and fix the chain across the road. It wouldn't be the first time this place drew him. And best, snow was coming, and snow would bury his tracks. He dropped his bulk into the bucket seat, shifted into reverse, and backed up 200 feet. Then he dropped the drive selector all the way down into low range and hit the gas. The Mustang went like its name. The engine was snarling, and the RPM gauge the owner had installed was redlining. So Blaze knocked the gear shift up into drive with the side of his hand, figuring he could downshift again if this little stolen pony really started to labor. He hit the snow. The Mustang tried to skid, but he went with it, and his pretty little nose came back around. He drove like a man in a memory that is half a dream. Counting on that dream to keep him out of the hidden ditches to either side where the Mustang would mire. Snow spumed up in fans on either side of the speeding car. Crows rose from trashwood pines and lumbered into the scum-white sky. He crested the first hill. Beyond it, the road bent left. The car tried to skid again, and Blaze once more rode it on the very edge of control. The wheel turning itself under his hands for a moment, then coming back to his grip as the tires found some thin traction. Snow flew up and covered the windshield. Blaze started the wipers, but for a moment he was driving blind, laughing with terror and exhilaration. When the windshield cleared again, he saw the main gate dead ahead. It was closed, but it was too late to do anything about it except put a steadying hand on the sleeping baby's chest and pray. The Mustang was doing 40 and running rocker panel deep in snow. There was a bitter clang that shivered the car's frame and no doubt destroyed its alignment forever. Board split and flew. The Mustang fishtailed, spun, stalled. Blaze reached out a hand to restart the engine, but it faltered and fell away. There, in front of him, brooded Hetton House. 3 stories of sooty red brick. He looked at the boarded-up windows, transfixed. It had been the same way the other times he'd come out here. Old memories stirred, took on color, started to walk. John Cheltzman doing his homework for him. The law finding out. The discovered wallet. The long nights spent planning how they'd spend the money in the wallet.
whispering bed to bed after lights out, the smell of floor varnish and chalk, the forbidding pictures on the walls with eyes that seemed to follow you. There were two signs on the door. One said, "No trespassing, by order of Sheriff, Cumberland County." The other said, "For sale or lease, see or call Gerald Clutterbuck Realty, Castle Rock, Maine." Blaze started the Mustang, shifted to low, and crept forward. The wheels kept trying to spin, and he had to keep the steering wheel left-hauled in order to stay straight. But the little car was still willing to work, and he slowly made his way down the east side of the main building. There was a little space between it and the long, low storage shed next door. He drove the Mustang in there, mashing the accelerator all the way to the floorboards to keep it moving. When he turned it off, the silence was deafening. He didn't need anyone to tell him that the Mustang had finished its tour of duty, at least with him. It would be here until spring. Blaze shivered, although it wasn't cold in the car. He felt as if he had come home. To stay. He forced the back door and brought Joe inside, wrapped snugly in three of his blankets. It felt colder inside than out. It felt as if cold had settled into the building's very bones. He took the baby up to Martin Koslaw's office. The name had been scraped off the frosted glass panel, and the room beyond was a bare box. There was no feel of the law in here now. Blaze tried to remember who would come after him and couldn't. He'd been gone by then, anyway. Gone to North Windham, where the bad boys go. He laid Joe down on the floor and began to prowl the building. There were a few desks, some scattered hunks of wood, some crumpled paper. He scavenged an armload, carried it back to the office, and built a fire in the tiny fireplace set into the wall. When it was going to his satisfaction, and he was sure the chimney was going to draw, he went back to the Mustang and began to unload. By noon he was established. The baby was tucked into his cradle, still sleeping, although showing signs of waking up. His diapers and canned dinners were carefully arranged on the shelves. Blaze had found a chair for himself and spread two blankets in the corner for a bed. The room was a little warmer, but a fundamental chill remained. It oozed from the walls and blew under the door. He would have to keep the kid bundled up good. Blaze shrugged on his jacket and went out, first down the road to the chain. He strung it back in place and was pleased to find that the lock, although broken, would still close. You'd have to get your nose practically right down on top of it to see it wasn't right. Then he retreated to the destroyed main gate. Here he propped up the big pieces as well as he could. It looked pretty shitty, but at least when he jammed the pieces down in the snow as far as they'd go, he was sweating heavily now, they stood upright. And hell, if anyone got this close, he was in trouble anyway. He was dumb, but not that dumb. When he got back, Joe was awake and screaming lustily. This no longer terrified Blaze as it had at first. He dressed the kid in his little jacket, green and cute, then set him on the floor to paddle around. While Joe tried to crawl, Blaze opened a beef dinner. He couldn't find the damn spoon. It would probably show up eventually, most things did. And so he fed the kid off the end of his finger. He was delighted to find Joe had gotten another tooth through in the night. That made a total of three. "Sorry it's cold," Blaze said. "We'll work something out, okay?" Joe didn't care that his dinner was cold. He ate greedily. Then after he was finished, he began to cry with the bellyache. Blaze knew that for what it was. He now knew the difference between bellyache crying, teething crying, and I'm tired crying. He put Joe on his shoulder and walked around the room with him, rubbing his back and crooning. Then when he kept crying, Blaze walked up and down the cold corridor with him, still crooning. Joe began to shiver as well as to cry, so Blaze wrapped him in a blanket and flipped the corner of it over Joe's head like a hood. He climbed to the third floor and went into room 7, where he and Martin Koslaw had originally met in arithmetic. There were three desks left, piled in the corner. On top of one, nearly hidden by entwinings of later graffiti, hearts, male and female sexual equipment, adjurations to suck and bend over, he saw the initials CB, done in his own careful block letters. Wonderingly, he took off a glove and let his fingers trail over the ancient cuts. A boy he barely remembered had been here before him. It was incredible, and, in a strange way that made him think of birds sitting alone on telephone wires, sad. The cuts were old, the damage to the wood rubbed smooth by time. The wood had accepted them, made them part of itself. He seemed to hear a chuckle behind him and whirled. George? No answer. The word echoed away, then bounced back. It seemed to mock him. It seemed to say there was no million. There was just this room. This room where he had been embarrassed and frightened. This room where he had failed to learn. Joe stirred on his shoulder and sneezed. His nose was red. He began to cry. The noise was frail in the cold and empty building. The damp brick seemed to suck it up. There, Blaze crooned. It's all right. Don't cry. I'm here. It's all right. You're fine. I'm fine. The baby was shivering again, and Blaze decided to take him back down to the law's office. He would put him in his cradle by the fireplace, with an extra blanket. It's all right, honey. It's good. It's fine. But Joe cried until he was exhausted. And not too long after that, it began to spit snow. Chapter 18. The summer after their Boston adventure, Blaze and Johnny Cheltzman went out blueberry raking with some other boys from Hetton House. The man who hired them, Harry Bluenote, was a straight. Not in the contemptuous sense in which Blaze would later hear George use the word, but in the best Lord Baden-Powell tradition. He owned 50 acres of prime blueberry land in West Harlow and burned it over every other spring. Each July he hired a crew of 24 or so young misfits to rake it. There was nothing in it for him other than the thin money any small farmer gets from a cash crop. He might have hired boys from HH and girls from the Wiscasset Home for Troubled Girls and given them 3 cents a quart. They would have taken it and counted themselves lucky to be out in the fresh air. Instead, he gave them the straight 7 that local kids asked for and got. The money for bus transportation to and from the fields came out of his own pocket. He was a tall, scrawny old Yankee with a deeply seamed face and pale eyes. If you looked into those eyes too long, you came away with the conviction that he was crazy. He was not a member of the Grange or any other farmers' association. They would not have had him anyway. Not a man who hired criminals to pick his berries. And they were criminals, damn it, whether they were 16 or 61. They came into a decent little town, and decent folks felt like they had to lock their doors. They had to watch out for strange teenagers walking the roads. Boys and girls. Put them together, criminal boys and criminal girls, and what you got was no better than Sodom and Gomorrah. Everyone said so. It was wrong, especially when you were trying to raise your own young ones upright. The season lasted from the second week of July into the third or fourth week of August. Bluenote had constructed 10 cabins down by the Royal River, which ran smack through the middle of his property. There were 6 boys' cabins and 4 girls' cabins in another cluster at a little distance. Because of their relative positions on the river, the boys' quarters were called Riffle Cabins and the girls' Bend Cabins. One of Bluenote's sons, Douglas, stayed with the boys. Bluenote advertised each June for a woman to stay at Bend Cabins, someone who could double as a camp mom and a cook. He paid her well, and this came out of his own pocket, too. The whole scandalous affair came up at town meeting one year, when a Southwest Bend coalition tried to force a reassessment of the taxes on Blue Note's property. The idea seemed to be to cut his profit margin enough to make his Pinko social welfare programs impossible. Blue Note said nothing until the discussions closed. His boy Dougie and two or three friends from his end of town had more than held up his side. Then, just before Mr. Moderator gaveled the discussion to a close, he rose and asked to be recognized, which he was, reluctantly. He said,
"There's not a single one of you lost a single thing during raking time. There's never been a single car theft or home break-in or act of bon arson, not so much as a stolen soup spoon. All I want to do is show these kids what a good life gets you. What they do about it after they've seen it is up to them. Ain't none of you ever been stuck in the mud and needed a push? I won't ask you how you can be for this and still call yourselves Christians, because one of you would have some kind of answer out of what I call the Holy Joe Do It My Way Bible. But Jeezly Crow, how can you read the parable of the Good Samaritan on Sunday and then say you're for a thing like this on Monday night?"
At that, Beatrice McCafferty exploded, heaving herself up from her folding chair, which might have given a creak of thanks, and without waiting for so much as a nod of recognition from Mr. Moderator, she trumpeted,
"All right, let's get to it, hanky-panky. You want to stand there, Harry Blue Note, and say there's never been none between the boys in that one bunch of cabins and the girls in t'other?"
She looked around, grim as a shovel.
"I wonder if Mr. Blue Note was born yesterday. I wonder what he thinks goes on in the dead of night, if it ain't robbery or barn burning."
Harry Blue Note did not sit during this. He stood on the other side of the meeting hall with his thumbs hooked into his suspenders. His face was the dusty, ruddy color of any farmer's face. His pale, peculiar eyes might have been tipped just the slightest bit at the corners with amusement. Or not. When he was sure she was finished, had her say, he spoke calmly and flatly.
"I ain't never peaked, Beatrice, but it sure as hell ain't rape."
And with that, the matter was tabled for further discussion, which in northern New England is the polite term for purgatory. John Cheltzman and the other boys from Hetton House were enthusiastic about the trip from the first, but Blaze had his doubts. When it came to working out, he remembered the Bowies too well. Toe Jam couldn't stop talking about finding a girl to jazz around with. Blaze didn't believe he himself had to spend much time worrying about that. He still thought about Marjorie Thurlow, but what was the sense in thinking about the rest of them? Girls like tough guys, fellows who could kid them along like the guys in the movies did. Besides, girls scared him. Going into the toilet stall at HH with Toe Jam's treasured copy of Girl Digest and beating off did him fine. Did him right when he was wrong. So far as he'd been able to tell from listening to the other boys, the feeling you got from beating off and the feeling you got from sticking it in stacked up about the same. And there was this to be said for beating off. You could do it 4 or 5 times a day. At 15, Blaze was finally reaching full growth. He was 6.5 feet tall, and the string John stretched from shoulder to shoulder one day measured out 28 inches. His hair was brown, coarse, thick, and oily. His hands were blocks measuring 1 foot from thumb to pinky when spread. His eyes were bottle green, brilliant, and arresting. Not a dummy's eyes at all. He made the other boys look like pygmies, yet they teased him with easy, impudent openness. They had accepted John Cheltzman, now commonly known as J.C., or Jeepers Cripe, as Blaze's personal totem. And because of their Boston adventure, the two boys had become folk heroes in the closed society of Hetton House. Blaze had achieved an even more special place. Anyone who has ever seen toddlers flocking around a St. Bernard will know what it was. When they arrived at the Blue Note place, Dougie Blue Note was waiting to take them to their cabins.
He told them they would be sharing riffle cabins that summer with half a dozen boys from South Portland Correctional. Mouths tightened at this news. South Portland boys were known as ballbusters of the first water. Blaze was in cabin three with John and Toe Jam. John had grown thinner since the trip to Beantown. His rheumatic fever had been diagnosed by the Hetton House doctor, a camel-smoking old quack named Donald Huff, as nothing but a bad case of the flu. This diagnosis would kill John, but not for another year. "Here's your cabin," Doug Bluenote said. He had his father's farmer's face, but not his father's strange pale eyes. "There's a lot of boys used it before you. If you like it, take care of it, so a lot of boys can use it after you. There's a wood stove if it gets chilly at night, but it probably won't. There's four beds, so you get to choose. If we pick up another fella, he gets the one left over. There's a hot plate for snacks and coffee. Unplug it last thing you do before you leave in the mornings. Unplug it last thing before turning in at night. There's ashtrays. Your butts go there, not on the floor, not in the dooryard. There isn't to be any drinking or playing poker. If me or my dad catches you drinking or playing poker, you're done. No second chances. Breakfast at 6, in the big house. You'll get lunch at noon, and you'll eat it in the yonder." He waved his arm in the general direction of the blueberry fields. "Supper at 6 in the big house. You start in raking tomorrow at 7. Good day to you, gentlemen." When he was gone, they poked around. It wasn't a bad place. The stove was an old Invincible with a Dutch oven. The beds were all on the floor. For the first time in years, they would not be stacked up like coins in a slot. There was a fairly large common room in addition to the kitchen and the two bedrooms. Here was a bookcase made out of a Pomona orange crate. It contained the Bible, a sex manual for young people, 10 Nights in a Barroom, and Gone with the Wind. There was a faded hooked rug on the floor. The floor itself was of loose boards, very different from the tile and varnished wood of H.H. These boards rumbled underfoot when you walked on them. While the others were making their beds, Blaze went out on the porch to look for the river. The river was there. It ran through a gentle depression at this point in its course, but not too far upstream he could hear the lulling thunder of a rapids. Gnarled trees, oak and willow, leaned over the water as if to see their reflections. Dragonflies and sewing needles and skeeters flew just above the surface, sometimes stitching it. Far away, in the distance, came the rough buzz of a cicada. Blaze felt something in him loosen. He sat down on the top step of the porch. After a while, John came out and sat beside him. "Where's Toe?" Blaze asked. "Reading that sex book. He's looking for pictures." "He find any?" "Not yet." They sat quiet for a while. "Blaze?" "Yeah." "It's not so bad, is it?" "No." But he still remembered the Bowies. They walked down to the big house at 5:30. The path followed the river's course and soon brought them to the Bend cabins, where half a dozen girls were clustered. The boys from H.H. and the ballbusters from South Portland kept walking, as if they were around girls, girls with breasts, every damn day. The girls joined them, some putting on lipstick as they chatted with each other, like being around boys, boys with beard shadows, was as common as swatting flies. One or two were wearing nylons, the rest were in bobby socks. The bobby socks were all folded at exactly the same position on the shin. Makeup had been laid over blemishes, in some cases to the thickness of cupcake frosting. One girl, much envied by the others, was sporting green eyeshadow. All of them had perfected the sort of hip-rolling walk John Cheltzman later called the streetwalker strut. One of the South Portland ballbusters hawked and spat. Then he picked a piece of alfalfa grass to stick between his teeth. The other boys regarded this closely and tried to think of something, anything, they themselves could do in order to demonstrate their nonchalance around the fairer sex. Most settled for hawking and spitting. Some originalists stuck their hands in their back pockets. Some did both. The South Portland boys probably had the advantage of the Hetton boys. When it came to girls, the supply was greater in the city. The mothers of the South Portland boys might have been juicers, hypes, and $10 lovers, their sisters two-buck handjob honeys, but the ballbusters in most cases at least grasped the essential idea of girls. The HH boys lived in an almost exclusively male society. Their sex education consisted of guest lectures from local clergy. Most of these country preachers informed the boys that masturbation made you foolish, and the risks of intercourse included a penis that turned black from disease and began to stink. They also had Toe Jam's occasional dirty mags, Girl Digest, the latest and best. Their ideas on how to converse with girls came from the movies. About actual intercourse, they had no idea, because, as Toe once sadly observed, they only showed fucking in French movies. The only French movie they had ever seen was The French Connection. And so the walk from Bend Cabins to the Big House was accomplished mostly in tense, but not antagonistic, silence. Had they not been quite so involved in trying to cope with their new situation, they might have spared a glance for Dougie Blue Note, who was doing his mighty best to keep a straight face. Harry Blue Note was leaning against the dining room door when they came in. Boys and girls alike gawked at the pictures on the walls, Currier and Ives, N.C. Wyeth. The old and mellow furniture, the long dining table with Cetaspell carved on one bench and Come Hungry, Leave Full carved on the other. Most of all, they looked at the large oil portrait on the east wall. This was Marion Blue Note, Harry's late wife. They might have considered themselves tough, in some ways they were, but they were still only children, sporting their first sex characteristics. They instinctively formed themselves into the lines that had been their entire lives. Blue Note let them. Then he shook hands with each one as he or she filed into the room. He nodded in courtly fashion to the girls, in no way betraying that they were got up like Cupid dolls. Blaze was last. He towered over Blue Note by half a foot. But he was shuffling his feet and looking at the floor and wishing he were back at HH. This was too hard. This was awful. His tongue was plastered to the roof of his mouth. He thrust his hand out blindly. Blue Note shook it.
Christ, ain't you a big one? Not built for raking berries, though.
Blaze looked at him dumbly.
You want to drive truck?
Blaze gulped. There seemed to be something caught in his throat that wouldn't go down.
I don't know how to drive, sir. I'll teach you, Blue Note said. It ain't hard. Go on in and get yourself your dinner.
Blaze went in. The table was mahogany. It glittered like a pool. Places were set up and down both sides. Overhead glittered a chandelier, just like in a movie. Blaze sat down, feeling hot and cold. There was a girl on his left, and that made his confusion worse. Every time he glanced that way, his eye fell on the jut of her breasts. He tried to do something about this and couldn't. They were just there, taking up space in the world. Blue Note and the camp mom served out. There was beef stew and a whole turkey. There was a huge wooden bowl heaped with salad and three kinds of dressing. There was a plate of wax beans, one of peas, one of sliced carrots. There was a ceramic pot filled with mashed potatoes. When all the food was on the table and everyone was seated before their shining plates, silence dropped like a rock. The boys and girls stared at this feast as if at a hallucination. Somewhere a belly rumbled. It sounded like a truck crossing a plank bridge.
All right, Blue Note said.
He was sitting at the head of the table with the camp mom on his left. His son sat at the foot.
Let's have some grace.
They bowed their heads and awaited the sermon. Lord, Blue Note said, bless these boys and girls, and bless this food to their use. Amen.
They blinked at each other surreptitiously, trying to decide if it was a joke or a trick. Amen meant you could eat. But if that was the case now, they had just heard the shortest goddamn grace in the history of the world.
Pass me that stew, Blue Note said.
That summer's raking crew fell to with a will. Blue Note and his son showed up at the big house the next morning after breakfast, driving 2 Ford 2-tons. The boys and girls climbed into the trucks and were driven to the first blueberry field. The girls were dressed in slacks this morning. Their faces were puffy with sleep and mostly free of makeup. They looked younger, softer. Conversations began. They were awkward at first, but became more natural. When the trucks hit field bumps, everyone laughed. There were no formal introductions. Sally Ann Robichaux had Winston's and shared out the pack. Even Blaze, sitting on the end, got one. One of the ball busters from South Portland began discussing girly books with Toe Jam. It turned out that this fellow, Brian Wick, just happened to have come to the Blue Note farm equipped with a pocket-sized digest called Fizzy. Toe allowed that he had heard good things about Fizzy, and the two of them worked out a trade. The girls managed to ignore this and look indignant at the same time. They arrived. The low blueberry bushes were in full fruit. Harry and Douglas Blue Note dropped the truck tailgates and everyone jumped down. The field had been divided into strips with white cloth pennants fluttering from low stakes. Another truck, older, bigger, pulled up. This one had high canvas sides. It was driven by a small black man named Sonny. Blaze never heard Sonny say a single word. The Blue Notes gave their crew short, close-tined blueberry rakes. Only Blaze did not get one.
The rake is designed to take nothing but ripe berries, Blue Note said.
Behind him, Sonny got a fishing pole and creel out of the big truck. He clapped a straw hat on his head and started across the field toward a line of trees. He didn't look back.
But, Blue Note said, raising a finger, being an invention of human hand, it ain't perfect. It'll get some leaves and greenies as well. Don't let that worry you or slow you down. We pick 'em over back at the barn, and you'll be there, so don't worry we're shorting your wages. Got that?
Brian and Toe Jam, who would be inseparable pals by the end of the day, stood side by side, arms folded. They both nodded.
Now, just so's you know, Blue Note went on. His strange pale eyes glittered. I get 26 cents the quart. You get 7 cents. Makes it sound like I'm making 19 cents a quart on the sweat of your brow, but it ain't so. After all expenses, I make 10 cents the quart. 3 more'n you. That 3 cents is called capitalism. My field, my profit. You take a share. He repeated. Just so's you know. Any objections?
There were no objections. They seemed hypnotized in the hot morning sunshine.
Okay. I got me a driver. That'd be you, Hoss. I need a counter. You, kid. What's your name?
John. John Cheltzman.
Come over here.
He helped Johnny up into the back of the truck with the canvas sides and explained what had to be done. There were stacks of galvanized steel pails. He was to run and hand one to anyone who called for a bucket. Each empty bucket had a blank strip of white adhesive tape on the side. Johnny had to print the picker's name on each full bucket. Full buckets were tucked into a slotted frame that kept them from falling over and spilling while the truck was moving. There was also an ancient, dusty chalkboard to keep running totals on.
Okay, son, Blue Note said. Get 'em to line up and give 'em their buckets.
John went red, cleared his throat, and whispered for them to line up. Please. He looked as though he expected to be ganged up on. Instead, they lined up. Some of the girls were putting on headscarves or tucking gum into their mouths.
John handed them buckets, printing their names on the ID tapes in big black capital letters. The boys and girls chose their rows, and the day's work began. Blaze stood beside the truck and waited. There was a great formless excitement in his chest. To drive had been an ambition of his for years. It was as if Blue Note had read the secret language of his heart, if he meant it. Blue Note walked over.
What do they call you, son, besides Hoss?
Blaze sometimes. Sometimes Clay.
Okay, Blaze. Come here.
Blue Note led him to the cab of the truck and got behind the wheel.
This is a 3-speed international harvester. That means it's got 3 gears ahead and 1 for reverse. This here sticking up from the floor's the gear shift. See it?
Blaze nodded.
This I got my left foot on is the clutch. See that?
Blaze nodded.
Push it in when you want a shift. When you got the gear shift where you want it, let the clutch out again. Let it out too slow and she'll stall. Let it out too fast, pop it, and you're apt to spill all the berries and knock your friend on his fanny into the bargain, because she'll jerk. You understand?
Blaze nodded. The boys and girls had already worked a little distance up their first rows. Douglas Blue Note walked from one to the next, showing them the best way to handle the rake and avoid blisters. He also showed them the little wrist twist at the end of each pull that spilled out most of the leaves and little twigs. The elder Blue Note hawked and spat.
Don't worry about your gears. To start with, all you need to worry about is reverse and low range. Now, watch here, and I'll show you where those two are.
Blaze watched. It had taken him years to get the hang of addition and subtraction, and carrying numbers had been a mystery to him until John told him to think of it like carrying water. He picked up all the basic driving skills in the course of one morning. He stalled the truck only twice. Blue Note later told his son that he had never seen anyone learn the delicate balance between clutch and accelerator so quickly. What he said to Blaze was,
"You're doing good. Keep the tires off the bushes."
Blaze did more than drive. He also picked up everyone's pails, trotted them back to the truck, handed them to John, and brought back empties to the pickers. He spent the whole day with an unvarying grin on his face. His happiness was a germ that infected everyone. A thunder squall came up around 3 o'clock. The kids piled into the back of the big truck, obeying Blue Note's admonition to be damn careful where they sat.
"I'll drive back," Blue Note said, getting up on the running board.
He saw Blaze's face fall and grinned.
"Give it time, Hoss. Blaze, I mean."
"Okay. Where's that man, Sonny?"
"Cooking," Blue Note said briefly,
punching the clutch and engaging first gear.
"Fresh fish, if we're lucky. More stew, if we ain't. You want to run into town with me after dinner?"
Blaze nodded, too overcome to speak. That evening he looked on silently with Douglas as Harry Blue Note haggled with the buyer from Federal Foods, Inc., and got his price. Douglas drove home behind the wheel of one of the farm's Ford pickups. No one talked. Watching the road unroll before the headlights, Blaze thought, "I'm going somewhere." Then he thought, "I am somewhere." The first thought made him happy. The second was so big, it made him feel like crying. Days passed, then weeks, and there was a rhythm to it all. Up early, huge breakfast, work until noon, huge lunch in the field. Blaze had been known to consume as many as 4 sandwiches, and nobody told him no. Work until the afternoon thunder squalls put an end to it, or Sonny rang the big brass dinner bell, strokes that came across the hot, fleeting day like sounds heard in a vivid dream. Blue Note began letting Blaze drive to and from the fields along the back roads. He drove with increasing skill, until it was something like genius. He never spilled a single container from the low wooden slat holders. After dinner, he often went to Portland with Harry and Douglas and watched Harry do his dickers with the various food companies. July disappeared, wherever used months go. Then half of August. Soon summer would be over. Thinking of that made Blaze sad. Soon, Hetton House again. Then winter. Blaze could barely stand to think of another winter at Hetton. He had no idea how powerful Harry Blue Note's liking for him had become. The big boy was a natural peacemaker, and the picking had never gone more sweetly. Only one fistfight had broken out. Usually there were half a dozen. A boy named Henry Gillette accused one of the other South Portland boys of cheating at blackjack, technically not poker. Blaze simply picked Gillette up by the scruff of his neck and hauled him off. Then he made the other boy give Gillette his money back. Then in the third week of August, the icing on the cake. Blaze lost his virginity. The girl's name was Anne Bradstay. She was in Pittsfield for arson. She and her boyfriend had burned down 6 potato warehouses between Presque Isle and Mars Hill before getting caught. They said they did it because they couldn't think of anything else to do. It was fun to watch them burn. Anne said Curtis would call her up and say, "Let's go French frying," and off they'd go. The judge, who had lost a son, Curtis Preble's age, in Korea, had no understanding of such boredom, nor sympathy for it. He sentenced the boy to 6 years in Shawshank State Prison. Anne got a year in what the girls called the Pittsfield Kotex Factory. She didn't really mind. Her stepfather had busted her cherry for her when she was 13, and her older brother beat her when he was drunk, which was often. After that shit, Pittsfield was a vacation. She was not a bruised girl with a heart of gold, only a bruised girl. She was not mean, but she was acquisitive, with a crow's eye for shiny things. Toe, Brian Wick, and 2 other boys from South Portland pooled their resources and offered Anne $4 to lay Blaze. They had no motive save curiosity. Nobody told John Cheltzman. They were afraid he might tell Blaze, or even Doug Blue Note, but everyone else in camp knew. One night, someone from the boys' cabins went down to the well on the road to the big house with 2 pails, one for drinking, one for washing. That particular night was Toe Jam's turn, but he said he had the belly gripe and offered Blaze a quarter to go in his stead. "No, that's okay. I'll go for free," Blaze said, and got the buckets. Toe smirked at the quarter saved and went to tell his friend, Brian. The night was dark and fragrant. The moon was orange, just risen. Blaze walked stolidly, thinking of nothing. The buckets clashed together. When a light hand fell on his shoulder, he didn't jump. "Can I walk with you?" Anne asked. She held up her own buckets. "Sure," Blaze said. Then his tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth, and he began to blush. They walked side by side to the well. Anne whistled softly through her rotting teeth. When they got there, Blaze shifted the boards aside. The well was only 20 feet deep, but a pebble dropped into its rock-lined barrel made a mysterious, hollow splash. Timothy grass and wild roses grew luxuriously all around the concrete pad. Half a dozen old oaks stood around as if on guard. The moon peered through one of them now, casting pale gleams. "Can I get your water?" Blaze asked. His ears were burning.
"Yeah, that'd be nice."
"Sure," he said, grinning thoughtlessly. "Sure it would." He thought of Margie Thurlow, although this girl looked nothing like her. There was a length of sun-bleached rope tied to a ring bolt set in one corner of the cement. Blaze tied the free end of this rope to one of the buckets. He dropped it into the hole. There was a splash. Then they waited for it to fill up. Anne Bradstay was no expert in the art of seduction. She put her hand on the crotch of Blaze's jeans and grasped his penis. "Hey!" he said, surprised. "I like you," she said. "Why don't you screw me? Want to?" Blaze looked at her, struck dumb with amazement. Although within her hand, part of him was now beginning to speak its piece in the old language. The girl was wearing a long dress, but she had pulled it up to show her thighs. She was scrawny, but the moonlight was kind to her face. The shadows were even kinder. He kissed her clumsily, wrapping his arms around her. "Geez, you got a real Woody, don't you?" she asked, gasping for breath, and grasping his cock even harder. "Now take it easy, okay?" "Sure," Blaze said, and lifted her in his arms. He set her down in the Timothy. He unbuckled his belt. "I don't know nothing about this." Anne smiled, not without bitterness. "It's easy," she said. She pulled her dress up over her hips. She wasn't wearing underpants. He saw a thin triangle of dark hair in the moonlight and thought if he looked at it too long, it would kill him. She pointed matter-of-factly. "Stick your pecker in here." Blaze dropped his pants and climbed on. At a distance of about 20 feet, hunkered in some high pucky, Brian Wick looked at Toe Jam with wide eyes. He whispered, "Get a load of that tool." Toe tapped the side of his head and whispered, "I guess what God took away here, he put back down there. Now shut up." They turned to watch. The next day, Toe mentioned that he'd heard Blaze got more than water at the well. Blaze turned almost purple and showed his teeth before walking away. Toe never dared mention it again. Blaze became Anne's cavalier. He followed her everywhere and gave her his second blanket in case she got cold during the night. Anne enjoyed this. In her own way, she fell in love with him. She and he carried water for the girls' and boys' cabins for the rest of the picking, and no one ever said anything about it. They would not have dared. On the night before they were to go back to Hetton, Harry Bluenote asked Blaze if he would stay a bit after supper. Blaze said sure, but he began to feel uneasy. His first thought was that Mr. Bluenote had found out what he and Anne were doing down by the well and was mad. This made him feel bad because he liked Mr. Bluenote. When everyone else was gone, Bluenote lit a cigar and walked twice around the cleared supper table. He coughed. He rumpled his already rumpled hair. Then he nearly barked, "Look here, you want to stay on?" Blaze gaped, unable at first to get across the chasm between what he had believed Mr. Bluenote was going to say and what he had said.
"Well, would ya?"
"Yes," Blaze managed. "Yes, sure, sure."
"Good," Bluenote said, looking relieved. "Because Hetton House isn't for a boy like you. You're a good boy, but you need taking in hand. You try goddamn hard, but—"
He pointed at Blaze's head.
"How'd that happen?"
Blaze's hand went immediately to the bashed-in dent. He blushed.
"It's awful, ain't it? To look at, I mean. Lordy." "Well, it ain't pretty, but I seen worse."
Bluenote dropped into a chair.
"How'd it happen?"
"My dad go and pitch me downstairs. He is hung over or something. I don't remember very well. Anyway," he shrugged, "that's all."
"That's all, huh? Well, I guess it was enough."
He got up again, went to the cooler in the corner, drew himself a Dixie cup of water.
"I went to the doctor's today. I've been putting it off because sometimes I get these little flutters, and he gave me a clean bill. I was some relieved."
He drank his water, crumpled the cup, and tossed it into the wastebasket.
"A man gets older, that's the thing. You don't know nothing about that, but you will. He gets older, and his whole life starts to seem like a dream he had during an afternoon nap, you know?"
"Sure," Blaze said. He hadn't heard a word of it. Live here with Mr. Bluenote? He was just beginning to grasp what that might mean.
"I just wanted to make sure I could do right by you, if I went and took you on," Bluenote said.
He cocked a thumb at the picture of the woman on the wall.
She liked boys. She gave me 3 and died having the last. Dougie's the middle boy. Eldest is in Washington State, building planes for Boeing. Youngest died in a car accident 4 years ago. That was a sad thing, but I like to think he's with his ma now. Could be that's a stupid idea, but we take our comfort where we can. Don't we, Blaze?
Yes, sir, Blaze said. He was thinking about Anne at the well, Anne in the moonlight. Then he saw there were tears in Mr. Blue Note's eyes. They shocked him and frightened him a little.
Go on, Mr. Blue Note said, and don't linger too long at the well, you hear me?
But he did stop at the well. He told Anne what had happened, and she nodded. Then she began to cry, too.
What's wrong, Annie? He asked her. What's wrong, dear?
Nothing, she said. Draw my water, will you? I brought the buckets.
He drew the water. She watched him raptly. The last day's picking was over by 1 o'clock, and even Blaze could see the final haul didn't amount to much. Berries was over. He always drove now. He was in the cab of the truck, idling along and low, when Harry Blue Note called,
"Okay, Hughes. Up in the truck. Blaze'll drive back. Change your duds and come on down to the big house. Cake and ice cream."
They scrambled over the tailgate, yelling like a bunch of kiddies, and John had to yell back at them to watch out for the berries. Blaze was grinning. It felt like the kind of grin that might stay on all day. Blue Note walked around to the passenger side. His face looked pale under his tan, and there was sweat on his forehead.
"Mr. Blue Note, are you okay?"
"Sure," Harry Blue Note said.
He smiled his last smile.
"Just ate too much lunch, I guess. Take her in,
He grabbed his chest. Cords popped out on both sides of his neck. He stared full at Blaze, but not as if he was seeing him.
"What's wrong?"
Blaze asked.
"Ticker," Blue Note remarked,
then fell forward. His forehead smacked the metal dashboard. For a moment he clutched at the old torn seat cover with both hands, as if the world had turned upside down. Then he tilted sideways and fell out the open door onto the ground. Dougie Blue Note had been ambling around the hood of the truck. Now he broke into a run.
"Papa!" he screamed.
Blue Note died in his son's arms on the wild, jouncing ride back to the big house. Blaze hardly noticed. He was hunched over the big, cracked wheel of the IH truck, glaring at the unrolling dirt road like a madman. Blue Note shivered once, twice, like a dog caught out in the rain. And that was it. Mrs. Bricker, the camp mom, dropped a pitcher of lemonade on the floor when they carried him in. Ice cubes sprayed every which way on the plank pine. They took Blue Note into the parlor and put him on the couch. One arm dangled on the floor. Blaze picked it up and put it on Blue Note's chest. It fell off again. After that, Blaze just held it. Dougie Blue Note was in the dining room, standing beside the long table, which was set for the end-of-picking ice cream party. A small going-away present had been set beside each kid's plate, talking frantically on the phone. The other pickers clustered on the porch, looking in. All of them looked horrified, except for Johnny Chelsman, who looked relieved. Blaze had told him everything the night before. The doctor came and made a brief examination. When he was done, he pulled a blanket over Blue Note's face. Mrs. Bricker, who had stopped crying, started again.
"The ice cream," she said. "What will we do with all that ice cream? Oh, lands!"
She put her apron over her face, then all the way over her head, like a hood. "Have 'em come in and eat it," Doug Blue Note said. "You too, Blaze. Pitch in." Blaze shook his head. He felt like he might never be hungry again.
"Never mind, then," Doug said.
He ran his hands through his hair. "I'll have to call Hetton and South Portland, Pittsfield,
Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. He put his face to the wall and began to cry himself. Blaze just sat and looked at the covered shape on the couch. The station wagon from HH came first. Blaze sat in the back, looking out the dusty rear window. The big house dwindled and dwindled until it was finally lost to view. The others began to talk a little, but Blaze kept his silence. It was beginning to sink in. He tried to work it out in his mind and couldn't. It made no sense, but it was sinking in anyway. His face began to work. First his mouth twitched, then his eyes. His cheeks began to tremble. He couldn't control these things. They were beyond him. Finally, he began to cry. He put his forehead against the rear window of the station wagon and wept great, monotonous sobs that sounded like a horse neighing. The man driving was Martin Koslaw's brother-in-law. He said, "Somebody shut the moose up. How about it?" But nobody dared touch him. Ann Bradstay's baby was born 8.5 months later. It was a whopping boy, 10 pounds, 9 ounces. He was put up for adoption and taken almost immediately by a childless couple from Saco named Wyatt. Boy Bradstay became Rufus Wyatt. He was named All-State Tackle from his high school team when he was 17. All New England a year later. He went to Boston University with the intention of majoring in literature. He particularly enjoyed Shelley, Keats, and the American poet, James Dickey. Chapter 19. Dark came early, wrapped in snow. By 5 o'clock, the only light in the headmaster's office was the flickering fire on the hearth. Joe was sleeping soundly, but Blaze was worried about him. His breathing seemed fast, his nose was running, and his chest sounded rattly. Bright red blotches of color glowed in each cheek. The baby book said fever often accompanied teething, and sometimes a cold or cold symptoms. Cold was good enough for Blaze. He didn't know what symptoms were. The book said just keep him warm. Easy for the book writing guy to say. What was Blaze supposed to do when Joe woke up and wanted to crawl around? He had to call the Gerards now, tonight. They couldn't drop the money from a plane in this snowstorm, but the snow would probably stop by tomorrow night. He would get the money and keep Joe, too. Fuck those rich Republicans. He and Joe were for each other now. They would get away. Somehow. He stared into the fire and fell into a daydream. He saw himself lighting the road flares in a clearing, running lights of a small plane appearing overhead, wasp buzz of the engine, plane banks toward the signal, which is burning like a birthday cake, something white in the air, a parachute with a little suitcase attached to it. Then he's back here. He opens the suitcase. It's stacked with dough. Each bundle is neatly banded. Blaze counts it. It's all there. Next, he's on the small island of Acapulco, which he believed was in the Bahamas, although he supposed he could be wrong about that. He's bought himself a cabin on a high spur of land that overlooks the breakers. There are 2 bedrooms, one large, one small. There are 2 hammocks out back, one large, one small. Time passes. Maybe 5 years. And here comes a kid pounding up the beach, a beach that shines like a wet muscle in the sunlight. He's tanned. He's got long black hair, like an Indian brave's. He's waving. Blaze waves back. Again, Blaze seemed to hear the sound of fugitive laughter. He turned around sharply. No one was there. But the daydream was broken. He got up and poked his arms into his coat. He sat down and pulled on his boots. He was going to make this happen. His feet and his head were set, and when he got that way, he always did what he said he was going to do. It was his pride, the only one he had. He checked the baby again, then went out. He closed the office door behind him and clattered down the stairs.
George's gun was tucked in the waistband of his pants, and this time it was loaded. The wind coming across the old play yard was howling hard enough to push him into a stagger before he got used to it. Snow pelted his face, needling his cheeks and forehead. The tops of the trees leaned this way and that. New drifts were forming on the crusted layers of old snow, already 3 feet deep in places. He didn't need to worry about the tracks he'd made coming in anymore. He waded to the cyclone fence, wishing he had snowshoes, and climbed awkwardly over it. He landed in snow up to his thighs and began to flounder north, setting off cross-country toward Cumberland Center. It was 3 miles, and he was out of breath before he was halfway there. His face was numb. So were his hands and feet, despite heavy socks and gloves. Yet he kept on, making no attempt to go around drifts, but plowing straight through. Twice he stumbled over fences buried in the snow, one of them barbed wire that ripped his jeans and tore into his leg. He merely picked himself up and went on, not wasting breath on a curse. An hour after setting out, he entered a tree farm. Here, perfectly pruned little blue spruces marched away in rows, each one growing 6 feet from its fellows. Blaze was able to walk down a long, sheltered corridor where the snow was only 3 inches deep, and in some places, there was no snow at all. This was the Cumberland County Reserve, and it bordered the main road. When he reached the western border of the toy forest, he sat on top of the embankment, and then slid down to Route 289. Up the road, almost lost in the blowing snow, was a blinker light he remembered well, red on two sides, yellow on the other two. Beyond it, a few street lights glimmered like ghosts. Blaze crossed the road, which was snow-coated and empty of traffic, and walked up to the Exxon on the corner. A small pool of light on the side of the cinder-block building highlighted a payphone. Looking like an ambulatory snowman, Blaze stepped to it, hulked over it. He had a panicky moment when it seemed he had no change, but he found 2 quarters in his pants and another in his coat pocket. Then, bool! His money came back in the coin return. Directory assistance was free. "I want to call Joseph Girard," he said. "Ocoma." There was a blank pause, and then the operator gave him the number. Blaze wrote it on the fogged glass that shielded the phone from the worst of the snow, unaware that he had asked for an unlisted number, and the operator had given it to him per FBI instructions. This, of course, opened the floodgates to well-wishers and cranks. But if the kidnappers didn't call, the traceback equipment couldn't be used. Blaze dialed 0 and gave the lady the Girard phone number. He asked if that was a toll call. It was. He asked if he could talk 3 minutes for 75 cents. The operator said no. A 3-minute call to Ocoma would cost him $1.90. Did he have a telephone credit card? Blaze didn't. Blaze had no credit cards of any kind. The operator told him he could charge the call to his home phone, and there was a phone at the shack, although it hadn't rung a single time since George died, but Blaze was too clever for that. "Collect, then?" the operator suggested. "Collect, yeah," Blaze said. "Your name, sir?" "Clayton Blaisdell, Jr.," he said at once. In his relief at finding he hadn't made this long slog just to come up empty for lack of phone change, Blaze would not realize this tactical error for almost 2 hours. "Thank you, sir." "Thank you," Blaze said, feeling clever. Feeling cool as a fool. The phone rang only once on the other end before being picked up. "Yes?" The voice sounded wary and weary. "I've got your son," Blaze said.
"Mister, I've had 10 calls today saying the same thing. Prove it."
Blaze was flummoxed. He hadn't expected this.
"Well, he's not with me, you know. My partner's got him."
"Yeah?"
Nothing else, just yeah.
"I seen your wife when I come in," Blaze said.
It was the only thing he could think of.
"She's real pretty.
She was in a white nightie. You guys had a picture on the dresser. Well, three pictures, all put together. The voice on the other end said, "Tell me something else." But he didn't sound tired anymore. Blaze racked his brain. There was nothing else, nothing that would convince the stubborn man on the other end. Then there was. The old lady had a cat. That's why she came downstairs. She thought I was the cat. That I was... He racked his brain some more. "Mikey!" he shouted. "I'm sorry I hit her so hard. I sure didn't mean to, but I was scared." The man on the other end of the line began to cry. It was sudden and shocking.
"Is he all right? For God's sake, is Joey okay?"
There was a confused babble in the background. A woman seemed to be speaking. Another was yelling and crying. The one yelling and crying was probably the mother. Narmenians were probably specially emotional. Frenchies were the same way. "Don't hang up," Joseph Girard said. It just about had to be Girard. He sounded panicky.
"Is he okay?"
"Yeah, he's good," Blaze said. "Got another tooth through, that makes three. Diaper rash is clearing up good. We keep his bottom greased up real good. What's the matter with your wife? Is she too good to grease his bottom?" Girard was panting like a dog. "We'll do anything, mister. It's all your play." Blaze started a little at that. He had almost forgotten why he called. "Okay," he said. "Here's what I want you to do." In Portland, an AT&T operator was speaking to Special Agent in Charge Albert Sterling. "Cumberland Center," she said. "Gas station payphone." "Got it," he said, and pumped his fist in the air. "Get in a light plane tomorrow night at 8, Blaze said. He was beginning to feel uneasy, beginning to feel he'd been on the phone too long. "Start flying south along Route 1 toward the New Hampshire border. Fly low, got it?"
"Wait, I'm not sure."
"You better be sure," Blaze said. He tried to sound like George would. "Don't try to stall me, unless you want your kid back in a bag."
"Okay," Girard said. "Okay, I hear you. I'm just writing it down."
Sterling handed a scrap of paper to Bruce Granger and made dialing motions. Granger called the state police. "The pilot'll see a signal light," Blaze said. "Have the money in a suitcase attached to a parachute. Drop it like you wanted it to land right on top of the light. The signal. You can have the kid back the next day. I'll even send some of the stuff use on his bottom." A witticism occurred to him. "No extra charge." Then he looked at his free hand and saw he had crossed his fingers when he said they could have Joe back. Just like a little kid telling his first lie.
"Don't hang up," Girard said. "I don't think I quite understand."
"You're a smart guy," Blaze said. "I think you do." He hung up and left the Exxon station at a dead run, not sure why he was running, only knowing that it seemed like the right thing to do. The only thing. He ran under the blinker light, angled across the road, and scaled the embankment in giant leaps. Then he disappeared into the spruce-lined rows of the county reserve. Behind him, a giant monster with glaring white eyes came snarling over the hill. It plunged through the teeming air, 9-foot side wings sending up sprays of snow. The plow obliterated Blaze's tracks where they angled across the road. When two state police cars converged on the Exxon station 9 minutes later, Blaze's footprints up the embankment to the reserve were no more than blurry indentations. Even as the troopers stood around the payphone with their flashlights pointed, the wind did its work behind them. Sterling's phone rang 5 minutes later.
"He was here," the state cop on the other end said.
Sterling could hear wind blowing in the background. No, shrieking.
"He was here, but he's gone."
"Gone how?" Sterling asked. "Car or on foot?"
"Who knows? Plow went through just before we got here. But if I had to guess, I'd say he drove.
Nobody's asking you to guess. Gas station, anybody see him?
They're closed because of the storm. Even if they'd been open, the phone's on a wall around to the side.
Lucky son of a bitch, Sterling said.
Blind lucky son of a bitch. We surround that crappy little cabin in Apex and arrest 4 girly magazines and a jar of strained peas.
Tracks, or did the wind take them?
There were still tracks around the phone, the trooper said. Wind blurred the treads. Bet it was him.
Guessing again?
No, they were big.
Okay. Roadblocks, right?
Every road, big and small, the trooper said. It's happening as we speak.
Logging roads, too.
Logging roads, too, the trooper said.
He sounded insulted. Sterling didn't care.
So he's bottled up. Can we say that, trooper?
Yes.
Good. We're going in there with 300 guys soon as the weather lifts tomorrow. This has gone on too long.
Yes, sir.
Snowplow, Sterling said. My sister's rosy chinchilla.
He hung up.
By the time Blaze got back to HH, he was exhausted. He climbed the cyclone fence and fell face first into the snow on the other side. His nose was bloody. He had made his way back in just 35 minutes. He picked himself up, staggered around the building, and went inside. Joe's furious, agonized howls met him.
Christ!
He ran up the stairs 2 at a time and burst into Koslaw's office. The fire was out. The cradle was tipped over. Joe was lying on the floor. His head was covered with blood. His face was purple. His eyes were squeezed shut. His small hands powdered white with dust.
Joe! Blaze cried. Joe! Joe!
He swept the baby into his arms and ran into the corner where the diapers were stacked. He grabbed one and swabbed the gash on Joe's forehead. The blood seemed to be pouring out in freshets. There was a splinter sticking out of the wound. Blaze plucked it out and threw it on the floor. The baby struggled in his arms and screamed more loudly still. Blaze wiped away more blood, holding Joe firmly, and bent in for a closer look. The cut was jagged, but with the big splinter removed, it didn't look so bad. Thank Christ it hadn't been his eye. It could have been his eye. He found a bottle and gave it to Joe cold. Joe grabbed it with both hands and began to suck greedily. Panting, Blaze got a blanket and wrapped the baby in it. Then he laid down on his own blankets, with the wrapped baby on his chest. Blaze closed his eyes and was immediately seized by horrible vertigo. Everything in the world seemed to be slipping away. Joe, George, Johnny, Harry Bluenote, Anne Bradstay, birds on wires and nights on the road. Then he was all right again.
From now on, it's us, Joey, he said. You got me, and I got you. It'll be all right, okay?
Snow struck the windows in hard, rattling bursts. Joe turned his face from the rubber nipple and coughed thickly, his tongue popping out with the effort of his chest to clear itself. Then he took the nipple again. Beneath his hand, Blaze could feel the small heart hammering.
It's how we roll, Blaze said, and kissed the baby's bloody forehead.
They fell asleep together.